From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the Alien Hunter joins us. Here's what's happening. Nearly half of the nation's new COVID-19 cases are concentrated in just five states, including New York, which had the highest number of the new infections across the country, according to data. Together, New York, Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey account for 44% of all the new infections between March 29th and April 4th. That's almost 200,000 cases out of 450,000 seen nationwide. Wonder what's going on there with those states. European and British medicine regulators said they have found possible links between AstraZeneca's coronavirus vaccine and reports of very rare cases of brain blood clots. It's a setback for inoculation campaigns, to be sure. The coronavirus variant, first identified in the United Kingdom, is now the most common strain of coronavirus here in the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Studies have suggested that the UK variant is more contagious than the original strain, is possibly more dangerous, and associated with a higher risk of death. Let's check in with Howard Bloom, who's investigating such matters for us. Howard, what do you have for us this week?
Well, here's the situation. When it comes to the COVID pandemic, it's us against the mutants. Way back in January, the Centers for Disease Control predicted that a COVID mutation, the one you just mentioned, Britain's B117 variant, would soon be the dominant strain of the virus in the USA, and the prediction sounded laughable. There were only 76 cases of the British variant in the entire United States. But today, it's only 2.5 months later, and the head of the CDC, as you mentioned, Rochelle Walensky, announced that the prediction has already come true. The B117 British mutant is now the leading COVID infector in the USA. What's more, new research has actually pinned that number down about its infectiousness. It is 50% more infectious than the coronavirus we've been battling for the last year, which is wickedly infectious. And here's what it means. It means that the British mutation is hitting young people and spreading at daycare centers and at kids' sporting matches. It means the British variant is killing people in their 40s and their 50s. But B117 is not the only virus mutant in the rapidly growing COVID mutant zoo. There are at least five others on the list. First is the Brazilian strain. As you know, Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, mocks masking and encourages his citizens to protest in the street against lockdowns. The COVID virus is taking advantage of this Brazilian surrender. Brazil now tops the world in COVID fatalities with 4,200 COVID deaths a day as of yesterday. Only one nation has ever topped that figure, the United States. Worse, leading the COVID charge in Brazil is a unique COVID mutation, the P1 COVID variant. And that Brazilian mutant is spreading rapidly to other countries in South America, like Paraguay and Uruguay, which are both experiencing what the BBC calls record numbers of daily deaths. Even worse, the Brazilian P1 COVID mutant has jumped to North America, where it has gained a firm foothold in the country with which we share a 5,525-mile-long border, Canada, which means we are wide open to the Brazilian mutant's attack. There are 289 cases of the Brazilian P1 COVID variant in the USA as of yesterday. But if the Brazilian mutant follows the path of the British variant, it could soon rip through the American population. And that's not all. The COVID variation with really big potential is called the double mutant. The double mutant coronavirus seems to have gotten its start in India, but it's now kicking up its heels in San Francisco. It's called a double mutant because it has borrowed two new tools for prying its way into your cells and mine. It has borrowed one new crowbar from the Brazilian and South African variants, and another lever from a mutant that has sprung up in California. To quote USA Today, the double mutant is believed to be more transmissible than the original strain of COVID-19, and it's not yet known if it is resistant to vaccines. Then there's a mutation that has arisen in New York City called B1526, and there's a Columbus, Ohio mutant known as the Midwest variant. But the bottom line is this. The more we give the COVID viruses our bodies to use as test tubes, the more chances we give the COVID coronavirus to come up with new innovations and tools, innovations that can kill us, which means, as Dr. Anthony Fauci recommends, wear a mask and keep wearing it until the level of an infection in the community is extremely low, and keep social distancing, avoiding crowds in crowded places like restaurants and sports stadiums, you don't want to turn your body into a laboratory flask for the COVID virus.
All right, Howard, thanks. My jury's out on Anthony Fauci, though, I got to tell you that. The U.S. trade deficit surged to a record high in February as the nation's economic activity rebounded more quickly than that of its global rivals and could remain elevated this year, fingers crossed, with massive fiscal stimulus expected to spur the fastest growth in nearly four decades. Investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Catherine, what do you think about all this? Is it going to work or not?
I don't know, George. There's a competition between disinformation and the trade deficit, which can go to the moon faster. So I think there's you're watching a continuing globalization of the economy and a significant level of disaster capitalism in combination. So to me, it's impossible to tell if you look at the Commerce Department numbers how much of this is inflation versus increase in the real deficit, because inflation is with us. And the one thing I would say to this audience, this is a signal. If anything, if you look at your household budget, you're going to have to be prepared to deal with greater inflation over the next 12 months.
And what do you hear about President Biden possibly eliminating up to $50,000 in student debt, Catherine?
I don't know which way this will go. If you look at the student debt situation, as far as I'm concerned, it's a giant fraudulent inducement. If you ever got a real court case on the legality of what the federal government has done here, they're on the wrong side of the law. So this is a situation that needs to be addressed.
All right, Catherine. Catherine Austin Fitz, our advisor, and what a great job she does. A top scientist said contacting alien life is a terrible idea, and his words have been interpreted as a warning of inviting other species to rule Earth. It comes as NASA's James Webb Space Telescope is about to launch soon. We'll peek into the worlds at far reaches of the universe. The scientist, of course, who said this is none other than Michio Kaku. Up next, L.A. Marzulli joins us. Giants, are they still roaming the planet? Let's find out when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. L.A. Marzulli, noted author, lecturer, filmmaker. He has penned many books, including the Nephilim Trilogy, and received a honorary doctorate for the series from the Pacific International University. He is a regular contributor here on Coast to Coast. A number of DVDs, website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Book is called How the Nephilim Returned After the Flood. L.A., welcome back, my friend, and how are you coping with everything?
Everything is well, George. Always good to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
Tell us who the Nephilim are.
Well, to cut right to the chase, the Nephilim are the progeny, the offspring of fallen angelic beings and earth women, women of the earth. And they create, when they come together and they procreate, they basically, the offspring is some sort of a hybrid. It's part fallen angel, so it's got the DNA of a fallen angel. It's basically an eternal entity, but it also has a human side to it, and this is what the Nephilim are. This is a classic definition of it. People who track with this stuff, that's what they would say basically it is. But there's a whole bunch of people that don't believe the Nephilim ever existed or that fallen angels can't somehow procreate with earthly women. Of course, I take issue with that because I think the text is extremely clear, and we see evidence of it. I mean, if we didn't have physical evidence of it, then we could dismiss it as mythos. But we have physical evidence of it, and it's global.
Were the Nephilim good, well-intentioned, or not? Kind of a loaded question.
They were bloodthirsty. They were sexually deviant. They were cannibalistic. They ate and drank the blood of men and women. And the ones that came over here, the Native First Nation people, Native Americans, will tell you that they would raid the villages. This is right out of Chief Joseph. Sit down talking to Chief Joseph Riverwind, who said that they would raid the villages. They would come in and pick up a brave, take the head off, just rip the head off.
Oh, jeez.
And almost like drinking a Coca-Cola, tilt their head back. Remember, these things are like 10 and 12 feet tall. So they rip the head off the brave, and they drink the blood. Like drinking a Coke and then throw the body on the ground. Now, this is oral tradition in many of the tribes. They had these huge lances that were like over sometimes up to 3 feet in length. And they would come in and they would skewer the braves. Like this lance would run into, you know, three, basically skewer three of them. We know from the Kandahar Giant, and you were in that film in a Watcher series.
That's right.
We're appearing in that. But we know that this Kandahar Giant was at least 12 feet tall. It came out of a cave in the Kandahar province in Afghanistan. And this thing moved with such agility and speed that it blew, I mean, everyone who was there on this patrol, maybe 15 guys, they were stunned. And who wouldn't be? All of a sudden you hear this piercing cry. This 12-foot thing comes out, dressed in like a loincloth, red hair, six fingers, double rows of teeth. And before you can do anything, it's running at you. And it spears one of the guys and holds it up. And that's when they said, shoot it in the head, shoot it in the head, and they brought the thing down. And that's a great story, and people would go, well, you know, where's the basic of a second witness? You talk to people, and I have since that story broke, who were at Kandahar years later, and the rumor's still going around. Going around about the giant that was killed. And you're not allowed to talk about it.
That's an incredible story. Now, the Hebrew Bible talked a lot about the Nephilim, didn't it?
Well, it does, and this is what this, the whole thing with the Nephilim, and everything hells back to Genesis 3:15, and this is what's so important to grasp, why they're here, and this was sort of the nexus of the entire book, Countermove, how the Nephilim returned after the flood. We know that they were here, but we know that something happens in Genesis 3:15. According to the biblical narrative, Adam and Eve in the garden, you got the dragon over here, and in my opinion, you've got the pre-incarnate Messiah, the pre-incarnate Christ, and he basically says something which sets up the rest of the entire biblical prophetic narrative. He points to the dragon and says, your seed, your offspring, pointing of a dragon, your seed, your offspring will be at enmity, at war, with the seed, the offspring of the woman. That offspring, he, the one coming from the woman's seed, will crush your head. You, the dragon, will bruise his heel. Well, that sets up the narrative. It's, as Gary Stearman would say, it's all about the seed. It's a seed war. It's genetics. It's the offspring of the dragon versus the offspring of the woman, the coming Messiah. And so what does the dragon do? Three chapters later, he creates the Nephilim. He has fallen angels go down on a mission. They land on Mount Hermon. That mountain is in Israel right now. I mean, you can go there and see it. It's called the Mountain of the Oath. And that whole idea is when these 200 watcher angels come down in the days of Jared, and they take wives. They take multiple wives, and they start to do the unthinkable. They procreate with them, creating this hybrid being, part angelic, part eternal, with the human woman, which becomes the Nephilim. And
so they are earthbound, weren't they?
Well, yes, the Nephilim are earthbound, but the fallen angels are not.
They are not, obviously.
They are not.
And when God went to Noah and said, build the ark, do this, and create this flood, and I'm speaking biblically here.
Right.
When he did that, was it to eradicate the Nephilim?
Exactly. It's exactly what's going on. And this is why it's so imperative. Unless we understand what's going on with Genesis 3:15, there's protocols in this ongoing heavenly war, which has been going on for millennia. We have no idea how far back it goes. The protocols are such that, you know, God could blink his eyes and the whole thing could be over. But that's not what he does. So what he does, he allows it to play out. And that's why Genesis 3:15 is so incredible, because here's the prophetic mandate. Well, the dragon sees that, knows someone that's going to come and take his kingdom from him, crush his head. And so what does he try to do? He has one shot. Poison the seed. Contaminate the seed of the woman so that won't happen. And he almost succeeds, except for the eight people on the ark. Except for the eight people. The corruption, George, it wasn't a weekend frat party with these guys. It was at least 400 to 600 years they were here, and they completely contaminated pretty much everything.
What did they want? What do they want with us?
Well, it's not what they want with us. They hate us. They want the planet. The dragon wants the planet. The dragon wants Earth. He wants the domain.
The dragon being Satan?
Exactly. And when Adam forfeited his right, he basically gave the title deed of Earth to the dragon. And so this, what we are engaged in is this war, which has continued literally for thousands of years, and I believe it's coming to a head even as we speak. The stuff that's going on now is just is absolutely incredible. So it's an ongoing war between the seed of the serpent, the dragon, and the seed of the woman. The one that will come from the woman will crush the dragon's head. That happened 2,000 years ago with the Messiah.
Not all of the Nephilim then died in the flood, obviously.
Yes, they were all drowned, and this is why I wrote the book, because it's in Christian circles there's all this controversy about this. Well, what, you know, how did they return if they're all dead? If the fallen angels were
right, yeah. If it was all gone, how'd they come back?
How'd they come back? And this is what's incredible about this. I have read this chapter in the Book of Enoch for years. I mean, like over. You know, 30 years I've read this chapter.
And this is new. This is something you discovered, right?
Correct. But it was the spirit of a living God who... Let me tell you the story, okay, real quick.
All right.
So I'm reading a book, and this guy has written a book about the Nephilim, and he's talking about that somehow one of the women, specifically Ham's wife, one of Noah's son's wives, got on the ark, and she was carrying a Nephilim gene. I never bought that. I still don't buy it. It's absurd. It makes God a trickster. Well, I'm going to kill everybody on the earth and drown them because they're all contaminated with Nephilim DNA on some level. Oh, but I'll let one sneak in on the ark. Not buy it. What we see in the Book of Enoch, it says this. And before I give you the punchline, so I'm laying in bed, and I'm praying. I'm going, you know, I can't read Hebrew. I'm not like a biblical scholar. And some people say, well, yes, you are. Okay, well, we can argue about that. But I can't read Hebrew. I can't read Greek. So, you know, I mean, who am I to really delve into this? And I know this might sound a little woo-woo, but this is the way it works. The Spirit of Living God says, what happens at the end of World War II? And I'm sitting there going, what does this have to do with the Nephilim? And I'm thinking about it, and he goes, what did the Japanese do at the end of World War II? And I don't know. And he said, what about the kamikazes? And I went, oh, my gosh, why did they do that? Because they realized that the war was lost, and this was a last-ditch effort. It was a suicide mission. And then the Lord goes, now turn to the Book of Enoch and read that. And I know it by heart. So Semyazi, this fallen angel, is on Mount Hermon with the 200 watcher angels. Now, this scripture has been in there for like 2,000 years. People have read it, but no one's ever looked at it like this. And Semyazi says this to the fallen angels, I fear that you will not agree to do this thing, and I alone shall have to bear the penalty of this great sin. Semyazi knows exactly what's going to happen, but he does it anyway because he's been promised that there's going to be a jailbreak. You're going to get out. We're going to get you out. This is how we win the war. And so it's a kamikaze mission. And when this happened, when I got that, I ran down. I told Peggy, my wife, and then I got on the phone, and it was in California. So it was 10 o'clock roughly my time here in California. I called Gary Stearman. It's midnight there, and we talked for an hour on the phone about this. That's how revelatory it was. And what I realized was that suicide mission, they do it again and again and again and again and again until the cross, and then it goes away, and then it changes. And that's where it gets in the prophecy of Daniel, where their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but they will, it's all about the seed, right? Their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to them. So who is the they? Their seed will mingle with the seed of men. It can't be men's seed. So it's a foreign seed. Once again, it goes back into the fallen angels. And the book, this book was sealed up until the end times. It says specifically, Daniel, seal up the words of this book until the time of the end. Men will run to and fro over the face of the earth, and knowledge will increase. That's exactly where we are now. The book is open. People like me, Chuck Missler, others, look at this verse and go, oh, my gosh, we're talking Nephilim. Their seed will mingle.
Interesting.
And in the book, Countermove, I take all the information that I just gave you, and of course it's expounded because it's a book. But towards the end of the book, I say, well, is this happening now? And it is. The prophecy of Daniel is screaming at us with the abduction phenomena, because that's exactly what happens. The seed is mingled, but there's no marriage.
Nobody has studied the Nephilim like you, L.A. Nobody. We're going to come back and talk more about this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, back with L.A. Marzulli, author of a number of books, including the Nephilim Trilogy. How many Nephilim do you think roam this planet now, L.A.?
Well, a lot of them are underground. For instance, the ones that are in Kandahar. And the thing, the alarming thing about that, George, we have no idea how old that thing was. I mean, the shooter that was there that came on the record anonymously, we have to, you know, disguise his voice and pixelate his face. He said that the stench of that thing was like a pile of rotted corpses, which I've never smelled anything like that, but I got a hunch it smells really bad. The question is, was he 2,000 years old, 1,000, 3,000? We have
right.
no idea.
We don't know.
We don't know. But there's more. There's others of them. And what alarmed us, or what kind of blew us away, is we got together with Steve Quayle, and we realized that Quayle's giant and our giant were two different giants, two different times, two different locations. So we know that there's more than one, absolutely. And we have another witness who was in Kandahar province, and when he was doing cave fighting, get this is in the film, and we had to disguise his voice and everything else too, because these people were taking a risk coming on the record. He said when they were being trained to fight in the caves, the instructor goes, aim high. And they were going, what do you mean aim high? Just take my word for it, aim high. That's all he would say. Well, why are we aiming high when, you know, I want to knock the guy in the chest and in the head, that type of thing. No, you want to aim high. That was the cave training. And so, you know, the rest is history. I was approached by a guy from the deep state and threatened three ways. And the reason, and I'm not making this up, I think I've told you this once before, but, new audience, new people need to hear this.
Absolutely.
I was approached by a guy from a deep state in Dallas at a conference. He had set up the meeting, and I had security with me. The guy was packing. My security guy was legally packing. He was there to protect me. This guy showed me his badge, showed me his, alphabet agency thing. And then his lead conversation to me was, well, what kind of phone do you have? And I go, I have an iPhone. Is it encrypted? I go, no. He goes, well, L.A., they could find kiddie porn on that. And I was immediately taken aback by that, saying myself.
Like they were going to accuse you of something.
Exactly. Next thing he goes, what kind of car do you drive? I drive a 1991 Mercedes SL500, which I restored. I bought it for next to nothing. And
oh, beautiful cars. So yeah, I gave Tom a 1985 SL as a gift.
They're just great. He goes, well, you could have an accident with that car, and we have ways of making that happen. So at this moment, I'm looking at him kind of going, this is unbelievable, saying to myself. And I'm scared. The third thing, he goes, do you have any kids? I go, yeah, I have two daughters. He goes, well, one of them could go missing and never be found. This is his opening salvo. And I looked at him and I said, I get it. You can do all that because you guys have all the power and I'm just a little worm because I got nothing. You can do all that. But you can't do that to me unless the living God allows it. And he'd never heard that before, and that shut him up, at least for a little bit. So about 2 months later, I had the almost near-death experience with the sports car. I was driving up one of the canyons, and all of a sudden I hear this tink. I lose control of the steering. There's no steering, and I'm headed to the cliff, jam on the brakes, crank the wheel to the left, fishtail to the stop, get out, pop the hood, and I look at the timing belt. And when the tow truck comes, I didn't say a word. I just said, hey, look at this. What do you think? The guy kind of looks at it carefully, and he goes, do you have any enemies? The belt was cut in 3 seconds.
Oh, geez, L.A., you got to be careful.
Yep.
Do the Nephilim have our kind of technology? I mean, look how we've advanced technologically. Have they gotten that kind of technology? Or are they still living, as you said, in a cave, but are they living like cavemen?
That's a really good question. The Nephilim, the hybrid entities. I would say this, that what we're seeing, Dr. David Jacobs wrote about this, walking amongst us, they can pass as human. These are the modern-day Nephilim, in my opinion, are the hybrid entities that people report having encounters with.
They're not giants?
They're not. No, they're not. And here's what's something interesting. Our work on the Paraca skulls, I was out with Tim Alberino, and we went
that.
Out way out into the reserve with an archaeologist, Peruvian archaeologist, and he showed us where they lived. Well, they had taken whalebone and made this like arch and then covered this arch way with seal skin and then put mollusk shells on top of that. Thing must have stunk to high heaven. And then they burrowed down 20 or 30 feet. So they lived underground. They weren't giants. The Paracas skulls are not giants. And I'm looking at this going like, well, I asked the archaeologist. I said, well, did they find evidence of torchlight down there? He goes, no. I go, well, how did they see? So I took the skull when I got back in the States. I took one of the replicas of a skull that Joe Taylor makes, and I went to an optometrist friend of mine, and I had him look at it. And immediately, and this is all in the film, one of the films that we did DNA, the final results, and he looked at it and he goes, well, first of all, the orbits, the eye sockets, are about 30% larger than a human's. Second, which is just incredible, the second factor is that the pupillary distance between the pupils should be about 65 millimeters. That's normal for a human being. These aren't. These are about 42 millimeter. I go, well, what does that mean? He goes, well, when you add all this together, larger eye sockets, the narrow pupillary distance, this thing probably had night vision and could see in the dark. I about fell over. He knew nothing about the cave, you know, cave dwellers, nothing about the underground Paracas people. And so what I discovered was that one of the Nephilim tribes, get this, drum roll please, is called the Horites, and the Horites are cave dwellers. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were giants. Yes, one of the Nephilim tribes, the Anakim, was long necks. Some of them were giants. I get that. But what we're seeing is there seems to be different genetic traits for different tribes. The Horites were cave dwellers. They weren't giants. But these elongated skulls going back to Paracas, we know that the DNA points to a Middle Eastern or a European haplogroup. And that rewrites history. They shouldn't be there, George, but they're there.
Should we be concerned that they're there?
Well, I mean, the quick answer to that is if hybrids are walking amongst us, and I believe that they are, I've talked to people who have had encounters with them. I don't want to have an encounter with them, but I've talked to people who have. And it's very, very unnerving. These entities are modern-day Nephilim, in my opinion. They are a mix of seed. They are a mixture of seed.
Do they know what they are?
Yeah, some of them do. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think that they do. But I haven't sat down and talked with one. I'm not sure I want to. But, you know, we'll see where it goes.
Have they infiltrated politics, governments, things like that?
Well, I mean, that's a rabbit hole. And you know, I can speculate on that. There's no way to know. The short answer to that is yes, that the whole Luciferian elite, and it's all one big happy little family there. But, yeah, I mean, there's an agenda. There's a cabal, and it's dark, and it has an agenda. And it's a very managed agenda, and it's controlled by the Prince of the Power of the Air.
What was it, L.A., that first got you interested in the Nephilim, that got you to do the trilogy, the DVDs, and everything else?
It was Dr. I.D. Thomas's book. I mean, as a Christian, as an early Christian, this goes back 40 years now, 41 years, okay? So I'm reading the Bible for the first time, and I'm trying to sort all this stuff out. So I get to the flood of Noah, and I freak out. I go, what's this guy doing? I get to the Tower of Babel. I freak out again. Why is he doing this? The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And you sit there and you go, you know, this Old Testament God, he's nasty. He's vengeful. He's maniacal. He's capricious and, you know, murderous. It's like, what's going on? Genocidal. And finally you get to the mandate when the children of Israel go in and take the promised land, and it's wipe everything out, kill every man, woman, and child, burn all the animals, destroy everything. That was it. And I just, you know, I knew about Jesus. I loved Jesus. That was really cool. I got that. But I could never reconcile what I was reading in the Old Testament with what, you know, with the New Testament with Jesus. It seemed like two different people. Entered Dr. I.D.E. Thomas's book, The Omega Conspiracy, changed my life. And when you factor in the Nephilim, everything I just said changes completely. The flood happens because it's move, counter move, move, counter move. The flood is a counter move by the Most High God to wipe out the Nephilim. The Tower of Babel is when it starts to come back in again with Nimrod. which is just absolutely incredible. And there were ties to Nimrod and Gilgamesh. This is why it goes back into the whole Anunnaki thing. It could be, they could be the same entities that we're talking about. So there is a connection, in my opinion, between Nimrod and Gilgamesh. He becomes a Nephilim. He becomes a Gibor through ritualistic sex magic. Well, jump into modernity with Aleister Crowley. Same thing, Babylon working, ritual sex magic, but I digress. So from Babel, it gets into Sodom and Gomorrah. Why is Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed? Same old thing. Nephilim, finally, the children of Israel going to the Promised Land. Who's there? The giants are there. We were like grasshoppers. The moment I understood, and thank God for Dr. Thomas's book, everything made sense. And then I realized, once I got a hold of the Seed War, Genesis 3:15, that we are in a cosmic conflict, which has a beginning, and it's going to have an end. And I think we're ramping up to it. But they're here. And they've been around for eons, and their seed is now mingling with the seed of men, but they're not cleaving to it. This is the work of Jim Williamson. They're not cleaving. There's no marriage like there was in the days of Noah, which is why Jesus says this for a prophecy here. It'll be like the days of Noah when I return. Why would he point to that, for crying out loud?
Right, exactly. That was a horrible time period.
Absolutely, but that's what it's going to be like, and I think that we're in that period of time.
And also a reason I think that you continue this mission, you are keeping the memory of your friend and production partner, Richard Shaw, alive. I think there's an undertone there that, and you ought to be commended for that.
You know, I miss him. It's not a day that goes by I don't think of him. And everything I know about filmmaking, I tip my hat off to Richard. I hope he taught me well. He did his best. I'm hoping I'm living up to it.
I think he is. He's up there now going right on. Right. Should we, as human beings, be concerned about what's going on here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if it's like the days of Noah, if there are hybrids running around, I defer once again to Dr. David Jacobs. And it's happening. I mean, Al Matthews, who we interviewed for our film on UFOs, I mean, Al had an encounter with a woman when she took off those glasses and she sat on him and he pushed her away and the eyes shapeshifted. The eyes shifted into serpentine-type eyes and she let out a hideous laugh that totally freaked him out and he ran out of there. He was absolutely freaked out. It was a hybrid. And I had stories, not a lot of them. But people write me these things. They shoot me emails, and then I call them and spend time with them on the phone. Most of them don't want any type of publicity. And that way you know that you've got pay dirt. If somebody wants money or, you know, they want fame or fortune or whatever, they want to get paid for the information, that's a whole different deal. But most of the people, I would say over 90% of the people I've ever dealt with don't want anything. In fact, they want to remain anonymous. They're embarrassed or not. They're still kind of sorting out, well, why did this happen to me type of thing. But I've had people come on the record that have had encounters with hybrid beings. It was a pastor friend of mine, Mike McClung, who had an encounter with one. I think I've told you this before, but he was out for a jog or like a prayer walk on a beautiful summer day. And in the distance, a very tall, very athletic woman, probably 6'4", 6'5", could be a volleyball player, basketball player, but platinum blonde hair, tied back, and she's running. And she, as she gets closer, their eyes meet, and she's got blue eyes. Well, the eyes shift into black when she's about 10 feet away. They just go totally black. All the whites are gone. They're just black eyes. And he immediately freaks out, goes into warfare praying. And as she comes by, she bares her teeth and growls at him. Now, what do you think that was? And he when this happened, he texted me immediately. We talked, and his sign-off was, "Welcome to the war." So, you know, this gets into the black-eyed kid stuff with David Weberly. Mm-hmm. We covered some of this in our Watchers. Stuff is happening, you know, but the thing that people need to take away without the fear is greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world. So as a born-again, spiritual Christian, I have the authority, not my authority, but the authority of the Messiah. If I see something like this, I can rebuke first, ask questions later, and that's sort of the motto.
How much of an influence, L.A., is Satan with all of this at this point?
I think all one needs to do is look at the lawlessness in the world and what's going on and realize that the prince of the power of the air is alive and well and doing his thing.
Is he winning?
Well, he wins temporarily. It looks like he's winning, but he's already defeated. He was defeated at the cross. That changed everything. That's we see the Nephilim appear over and over and over and over again. Josephus, first century Jewish historian, writes about it, and then it all just kind of disappears. When? After the cross, because it's game over. In fact, there's a paper, I remember Dr. Thomas, my mentor, showed me that paper by this theologian called Bullinger, and I also did some more research on Eastern Christianity, Eastern Orthodox, who talk about the same thing, when and it's in the Bible. When Jesus dies on the cross, most people don't know this, but it's there. When he dies on the cross, he goes to the lower parts called Tartarus. It's the lowest part, and there, according to Bullinger, it's a proclamation to the fallen angels.
Now, what do you mean it's the lowest part?
It's the lowest part. In other words, there seems to be compartments, and this is like the gloomiest dungeon, the lowest part.
Is it like hell?
Tartarus. It's like what?
Hell?
Well, it would be like hell, but it would be even darker and the lowest part. It's called Tartarus.
Huh.
And he's there, and it's a proclamation to those angels that sinned on Mount Hermon. They're bound in chains, but that's why it was a suicide mission. They knew what their fate was. They broke the law. Bam, that's the punishment. But they had been told, this is conjecture on my part, they had been told that there's going to be a jailbreak. You're going to get out. It's going to win. We're going to win. We're going to win. And they were promised stuff in the dragon's kingdom. So when the proclamation, when Jesus, he goes there first, George. He goes there first. And it's a proclamation to those angels, those fallen beings that did the unthinkable in the days of Jared on Mount Hermon and started the Nephilim by mingling the seed. He basically says, no jailbreak. You're not getting out. And that's when everything changes. The dragon, Satan, changes his tactics, and this prophecy ties in with Daniel. Their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but there'll be no marriage contract, and that's exactly what we see with the abduction phenomena. It's exactly what we see.
We're going to take calls with L.A. Marzulli next hour as we talk about the Nephilim. His website is lamarzulli.net. It's hooked up to coasttocoastam.com. And his books, of course, are all on his website, along with the DVDs. Any special offers for our listeners, L.A.?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a great coast-to-coast special. You get Counter Move plus a free DVD.
Counter Move's the new book, right?
Yep, that's the new book, How the Nephilim Returned After the Flood.
Super. All right, we're going to come back in just a moment. L.A. Marzulli, get ready to make the calls to talk about the Nephilim, who he says are still here. So get ready for that and much more just ahead on Coast to Coast AM.